pillar. Through our gender mainstreaming, it also has a pillar. Through our designated groups in terms of our employment equity targets, all that has been included in the strategy as well. This is giving you an idea in terms of how we envisage specifically to facilitate the implementation at the macro level. That's where we at the national level. At the meso level, what does the premier's office do? What do the premier's offices do, the provincial administration, to make sure that the strategy is implemented? What does the line department do, an institution do, against the capacity building, against the organizational systems and initiatives, the governance initiatives and economics, which means that we'll be meeting in the learning forum. Each one of those structures are reporting against where they have coordinated the actual implementation of the strategy. Something's happening, yes, sorry. Okay. From what the stakeholders were saying, there was a problem in that there wasn't an implementation guide. So even though the previous strategy came up with the conceptual framework, the challenges in terms of not implementing was there was no implementation guide to assist them. So what we've done is we then designed an implementation guide together with the same stakeholders, called them to a national workshop at Birchwood, fed back to them to say, this is what you said was the problem with regards to the implementation of the previous HRD strategy. We've come up with a draft implementation guide and a draft implementation plan. Can you validate that this is what you'd like to see happening, which would assist you in terms of implementing? What we saw was the Department of Labor and Department of Education is responsible for the country scorecard in terms of the South African HRD strategy. We say we as DPSA are responsible to make sure that there is a public service HRD strategic framework. What we say to line departments, education, health, justice, home affairs, foreign affairs, you as a sector must make sure that there's a sector HRD strategy for your particular sector that you are responsible for, that is driven by whatever specific sector growth and development strategy you've got in your sector. You've got your sector skills plan, and you've got your occupational specific needs. How many nurses you need, how many doctors you need, how many lawyers you need. That you need to be driving in terms of your strategy. Then, at the provincial level, the provincial administrations on a horizontal level have got your provincial growth and development strategies. And you then need to be driving the provincial HRD strategy in your particular province. Coming down to your departments then must have your line department strategies that's taken the mandate from the different strategies as it's been cascaded, because that has been translated into the departmental strategic plan, what is coming out there. So the component that is dealing with capacity and governance of the state in the strategic plan of a department will then be dealing with that particular issue. Going down, the operational plan for a directorate in a department that's responsible for HRD will then have the skills planning process, the workplace skills plan, and all the employees then must have their work plans in their individual performance contracts, in their performance management development, whatever performance management development system is applicable to them. And each individual then has their personal development plan. So you're clear in terms of the golden thread. But our responsibility as DPSA is where you've got the bright blue, and there's the rest then are what we would then be monitoring through the National Steering Committee for HRD to assist them in terms of making sure that they can implement the strategy. The whole skills planning process, the HRD skills strategy basically is the whole public service skills plan, which the PCTA is the driver. The sector skills plan, the organizational objectives is the organizational skills plan. This feeds into the outcomes-based job profiles, the individual profiles of individuals. The HR Connect skills database is doing just this, to come up with the individual skills gap of every employee in the public service, to assist them with printing out an individual skills development plan. So each job has got a competency, it's got a job profile, and what we are saying is where the individual has filled up their particular profile, it will then identify the skills gap, and therefore that will assist us with the skills audit, and it fills up with where the training needs and the development needs are needed for that particular employee or cohort of employee. The implementation process, as we said, there's a legal and political mandate. The stakeholder review will always tell us whether we're meeting or whether we're not meeting, what's supposed to happen. You design the conceptual framework, you design the strategic framework, you give the guidelines, you have an annual performance plan which the line departments customize and modify according to their needs. We have a monitoring and evaluation tool. We have a quarterly review, which is the HR steering committee reporting against the MNE tool. The steering committee basically feeds back in terms of where needs have to be, where support needs to be provided, and where the greatest need is in terms of line department support. And then an annual consultative conference, where everybody is brought together as an HRG annual consultative conference to measure whether we're meeting or whether we're not meeting our particular objectives against the HRG strategy. And to external control points like yourself, an annual performance review report to tell you whether it's happening or whether it's not happening against the MNE tool. And the MNE tool is against all the indicators that are in that conceptual framework that's got all those little blocks, those objectives under the pillars. Those then become what you are measuring and what we are reporting against to our external strategic control points. That, in a nutshell, is the actual strategy. There are four slides which just, I'll just give you an example of one without going into great detail. I took the one pillar out to show you, because it's in the actual strategy itself, to show you exactly the strategic intent, each one of those little boxes under the pillar. The first pillar was called Capacity Building Initiative. Each of them have got strategic intent. So what we've done for the line departments, the sector departments, we've unpacked what the intention is of each one of those, and then we've taken it and we've put it into, you will see under the implementation guide, you will see under the implementation guide at the back, we've designed a generic implementation plan for all line departments, which will be available electronically. They just fill up the dates and tick the boxes, whether they've done those activities, whether they've met the targets, and they submit that to us so that at least we can report against whether they're meeting their targets or not against the broader HRD strategy for the country. So that was the extensive process that we went through in terms of trying to deal with where the gaps are and addressing the aspects of a cogent HRD strategy for the public service. Thank you.
Thank you, Colette. I think that this is a narrative document, which is in line with your input. Okay. Before maybe I ask the members to comment and to raise questions, DG, the follow-up on the monitoring of the implementation of this HRD, do we have maybe monitoring structures? It's very exciting, and I'm impressed, but I'm not sure as to whether, as a member of committee, I'll be able to have time to look at all of this from time to time. Because it's good for the department to formulate such an objective, but at the end of the day, we need to have time frame of implementing it, and ensure that we are getting a feedback of the monitoring people. Are these departments implementing all what they are saying or not? If not, do they follow exactly the way in which you have formulated this? Because it's important. I'm not sure before the members maybe raise their questions, but maybe let's give the members a chance to raise questions and then we deal with what I'm saying. Jane?
Thank you, Chair. Like the chairperson, I think this really looks good, especially when you look at the slides and listen to the presentation. But now, we had what you call the HRDS1. We have implemented it, we have looked at the development of the and now we are coming up with this strategy, which I believe is an improvement on RDK, looking especially at the challenges that are facing. What I would like to know is, what, despite all the challenges that have been identified, what are the real gaps between what we have and and implementation? What is it that, what was the stumbling block that led to these challenges that are still there? How have we, with this group, how have we made sure that we are going to improve on what we have? And like what the chairperson has said, what are the monitoring tools, especially for us as politicians? Because I'm sure when we do our oversight now, we have got to see as to what was happening. This is how we have tried to improve, and this improvement is actually leading us where we want to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, flowing from the review of the HRD, one of the key recommendations is that there should be a policy for the utilization of the 1% skills levy. I haven't to speak my mind whether that recommendation has been taken into account or a policy has been developed. Because one of the critical challenges is that's a lot of money for the six-seater. And I think with the challenge around capacity and skill shortage, if there can be a clear policy, you know, how to use that, and it is actually being used, I think we can meet some of the challenges around the skills shortage. Thank you.
So let's, you want to respond maybe, or did you?
Thank you, Chairperson. I will respond to the questions that have been raised, but Colette, and if Sally wants to as well, can also talk to these matters. But I think you are basically asking us a simple question, and that is, what is the capacity that we have, and do we have the tools in place to monitor the implementation of this? Well, of course, this is a departure point, as it were. We're in the process of finalizing, launching this, getting the necessary approvals to take it forward and so on. But I think the question you're asking comes down to what we debate in the House this afternoon, in a sense. It relates to the challenges that we face as the DPSA in terms of a decentralized human resource management and development framework for the public service. We are the policy department. We formulate a wide range of policies in the area of human resource management and development, and then these must be implemented by line and sector departments. Obviously, the role that we play in terms of monitoring becomes critical. Now, as we adopt this new approach, we will put in place the necessary M&E capacity and tools. But if you look at the process itself, as articulated in the presentation, there are going to be annual processes which will take place within the new, or driven by the new governance structures as envisaged. So you are going to have annual performance reviews, you are going to have annual consultative processes, we are going to establish a national learning network, and through those processes and the actual implementation guidelines, which will allow for a standardized approach across the board, we will get the necessary reports which will allow us to perform the monitoring function that you are talking about. So I think that's really the fundamental answer to that question, and why we've been grappling with the whole question of compliance. Because at the end of the day, no matter that we develop this, departments can still carry on in the ad hoc manner that they have been carrying on. And obviously the review exposes that particular problem, and that relates to the Honourable Member's question about the 1%. And we know that the utilization is completely ad hoc, and it's not aligned with anything in the way in which it should be aligned. So this is actually quite a simple strategy. We're also saying, let's not come up with a long time-bound strategy like we did before. Let's really look at this thing on a year-by-year annual basis and keep it simple and straightforward. So that would be my response. But Colette and Sally will go into greater detail on the questions that have been raised. Thank you.
Yeah, to respond to the monitoring, if you look at the capacity building pillar, initially we had under promoting learnerships, internships, traineeships, and mentorships. But when we were discussing with stakeholders, they basically preferred it to be under the leadership management development strategy, to say that mentoring is about that. It's rather a leadership management and development strategy. So if you go through the actual strategy itself, you will find it's been unpacked there as one of the things that need to be done to ensure that there's a development of leadership management within, you know, within line departments. Just to share with you, we have already got a draft policy which obviously has to go up the policy pathway for the 1% utilization. What we are proposing is the following. Currently, just to share with the House, the PCTA was under, you know, the public service regulations before, and it's become a private entity, which means that it would be treated like any other CETA, any one of the other 23 CETAs, meaning the following, that the line departments that are public service organizations will then compulsorily have to submit workplace skills plans and annual training reports. Before, it wasn't compulsory for public service departments, which means that the terrain changes completely the minute the Minister of Labour has made that particular amendment. I saw the draft of the amendment last week, but it means that we then can make sure that we get those particular sector plans as well as the annual training reports, and we'd be able to then report against them. The issue of the funding with regards to the CETA, currently public sector departments are holding back at least 80% of the funding. Only 20% has been called off in terms of the running of the CETA. So for the 1% money that's in line departments, it's actually 80% of the 1%. And that is what they are utilizing discretionary, the way they would like to use it, whether it's on conferences or bursaries or generic training. In the proposed policy, we are saying that they should at least be 30%. We say 30% of the money should be set aside for pre-service training, which means that for learners that are coming out of school, at least 30% for your sector must provide bursaries to say they're going teaching, they're going nursing, they're going to become lawyers. So it's pre-service bursaries, which are then traineeships. So traineeship basically is where you've got a compulsory qualification that includes an internship with a qualification at the same time. As a teacher, you come out with a 4-year degree, but while you were training, you have to go and do a practical of 6 weeks every year. As a nurse, a 4-year qualification, these practicals that are compulsory, as a doctor and so forth. So those are traineeships. We're saying targeting traineeships, formal bursaries for the sector. We're saying the other 30% we're proposing is in-service. If you've got the professionals, at least 30% of that money should be targeted in improving them who are the professionals for your sector. And then 40% for generic other training. ICT training or whatever other training, conferences. Therefore, this 60% of your budget is being utilized to make sure that there is focus on the skill or the skill for that particular sector. So it definitely is quite an important thing in terms of getting that policy approved and out there. The aspects of the features, I think I've dealt with it in terms of what it's going to translate to, in relation to the compulsory workplace, skills plans, the sector plans, as well as the training report. But just as a developer, one of the things that the DG had raised, currently departments are not doing organizational capacity assessments. And the capacity assessment is to find out what are the developmental needs and what needs to be put in place. What we've done is come up with a tool to assist them in this particular strategy. How do they find out the organizational readiness and where are the gaps in relation to the development that needs to take place? Because that also assists in terms of the eventual monitoring and evaluating is around particular indicators which are included in the particular framework to assist them to find out whether they are meeting targets or whether they're not meeting targets, whether they've got challenges in terms of the organizational support systems. If the support systems are not there, then the whole HRD is not even taking place. So they have to measure the organizational readiness and then put strategies in place to deal with that before they can even, start dealing with the aspects of HRD. Thank you.
Still need to be educated for that. Really. If the monitoring mechanisms are not in place in all of this, we don't want to see this as a waste of time. But all the work that you've made and the money that is spent on that, we must be sure that at least there is a feedback in what is happening, so that we can devise new strategies to ensure that now there is implementation of what we are trying to do in this government. Now, we are not just interrogating this. We want to engage, and you also engage us, so that as we go along as politicians, we must know where are we going, where are we, and what needs to be done in order to achieve our objective in all what we are doing. Together with you, we understand, in criticizing what you are doing, and at the end, on the other hand, we are not bringing any input that helps you to move forward. It's also a futile exercise in what we are doing. Julie and Tembo?
Mr. Chief. DG, we can spend all the money to develop this plan, and because I think at the end of the day there should be an objective. But now my problem is not if we monitor and review each year what we achieve during the year. If, for instance, they say the CTAS, all of the CTAS doesn't perform as they should. Now, what are we going to do? Is there something in place where we say, if we spend all the money on you, give you all the training, everything is there, and you don't perform, then we're going to do X, Y, X with you. I mean, there should be something that says, if you don't do, if we spend this money and you don't perform, because service delivery is very important, if you don't perform, then we are going to get rid of you. Is there something like that? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, perhaps I will take you back. In the previous presentation, you an indication was given that DPSA is developing a national norms for HRD and development. And I wonder whether how does it link with this framework? Because I think with the current challenge of a decentralized HRD, and thus, you know, not giving a DPSA, you know, some means of having some control, I think the approach of come up with the national norms, it does give a leverage, although it may be just strategic compliance, but in any case, there can be some way of come up with some substantive, you know, compliance. So I want to know how far is that process and how does it link with this one, and we should also in part address the question of monitoring, was once they've got norms nationally, implicitly, you have to monitor compliance. You know. Success is not just strategic compliance. Thank you.
Thank you. A question of Julissa, I don't know who should act if there's no performance. Is it us or is it there? Do you have... Because sometimes I always call it compare the public sector or service with private. Because if you are given a task to perform in the private sector and you don't perform according to the requirements, something as Julius is asking must be done. Who's supposed to do that? It's you people that have formulated this, or what? Or the monitoring comes in when you check. Are we not complicating things for the people that are supposed to implement this? Because this theory is very good. Practically, will it work? Does it work? If not, why? What is the problem? It will help one another on these things, you know, to take it forward. Well, maybe you want to respond to the questions raised by Julius and Babang Tembo. It will help me too. Thank you.
I think that I'll respond to the one around the norms and standards, and the DG will add on in relation to that. I did indicate earlier on that tomorrow we will be launching the HR, the steering committees, which is an endeavor to have an HR learning network with all the live departments, the premier's office representing the provincial departments and all the national departments present. Maybe just to share with you, the HRD strategy is going to form the basis of the blueprint of what has to happen in all other HR functions. Currently, we are completing the following strategies. The leadership management and development strategy, which also has four different pillars for how managers, the leadership pipeline, supervisory, middle, senior, and executive managers need to be developed around a competency framework, around the leadership pipeline, which is quite comprehensive, which when we complete, we would also like to share it with the House as we are going along. The employee health and wellness strategic framework, exactly the same. It takes the four pillars, these four pillars, and puts it on this side, and then there's a pillar for each of the core things under employee health and wellness. Exactly the same for diversity management under job access, employment equity, and gender mainstreaming. These four pillars, what are you doing against all those? So what we're trying to do is every single HR function, employment practices, you have to have the HRD strategy integrated into everything that you do. If you are in charge of job access in a line department, can you tell us what are you doing around capacity building? What are you doing around organizational support systems? What are you doing around governance initiatives, economic growth and development initiatives? Hence, the whole idea is sharing with everybody nationally tomorrow what we expected them to do in terms of how they are thinking and planning in a different way in which they need to be working in order to institutionalize the HRD strategy. I think the issue of the norms and standards, these two projects which we shared with you last year, the 11th of November, there's the project around the national norms and standards for a single public service, which we are currently undergoing a research project with DPLG, UNOSAGA, and the different municipalities, trying to get for all these areas what should be the norms and standards for the whole public sector. But a parallel project is the repositioning of HR within the public service, which is looking at all the functions and how line departments need to configure the functions, need to deliver the functions, they need to capacitate. And we also have to come up, Cabinet has asked us to come up with a competency framework for anybody who is an HR practitioner in a line department who's going to be delivering all aspects of human resources in a line department, which is then separate from the norms and standards for the single public service that's looking at the norms and standards holistically. And hence, we are hoping that the learning network which we are launching tomorrow, which has been sponsored by an external provider for us, is bringing together all the HR persons to get them to understand how they need to work in a particular way and coordinate what they're doing and stop working in silos, whether they're in a province, whether they're in, you know, different spheres in government. And that's the intention. In fact, we talk about the whole aspect of collaborating with line departments, connecting with them, coordinating them for compliance. That's to try and get the compliance through a very integrative way in which we need to be working. And well, the launch of this particular process is also trying to get them to design the monitoring and evaluation tools together with them, therefore they understand what they are measuring, rather than just giving them the tools. Because what we're finding is that when you work with people as to what they need to be measuring, they're actually more cognizant in terms of what needs to be measured. And that is the vehicle in where we're going to try and ensure that compliance is happening.
Yeah, to sort of take it up a level, because I sense there is a question being asked here about how, as we sit in this house jointly, we engage in a process which will allow us to determine whether or not these frameworks are being successfully implemented, whether we are making progress, etc. I think what we're doing in the house later today in relation to this is taking some steps in terms of strengthening the mandate of the Public Service Commission, as well as introducing compliance reporting, if I can put it that way, through other aspects of the amendment bill. Because what we've done in South Africa with the advent of democracy and the public service transformation and reform programs that have flowed out of that, is that we have embraced a number of precepts of good governance practices, which are accepted globally as being the way forward for public service management and administration. And central to those is decentralized public management. It's public finance management, it's also public management, administration management, if you like. But we've done it in a context where we haven't really established norms and standards. We haven't established practice because we were in the process of transforming at the same time. So, unfortunately, to some extent, we did decentralize into a vacuum. And this is what we're grappling with. So we're not really trying to re-centralize. We're trying to ensure that the frameworks that we have created, which we believe are very progressive frameworks, And this is another example of an emerging progressive framework. We want to ensure that these frameworks are indeed implemented and that we are in a position from where we sit here in this house to determine the extent to which these frameworks are being rigorously implemented. And hence the need to establish the kind of compliance through the amendment bill and ultimately through the legislation that will support the Single Public Service Initiative. Because if we do not have norms and standards in place, not only will we not achieve what we want to achieve in this particular area, which is to develop our human resources to their full capacity, but we will have continued instability within the public service. And that is one of the key challenges, is to stabilize our public service, to be able to recruit and retain, and to stabilize what we have there at the moment. Because currently there's a lot of movement. We are unable to consolidate at a number of levels the things that we are trying to do, to provide the management infrastructure that will allow us to deliver on our key priorities of halving unemployment, etc., etc., which the public service has a key role to play in achieving these. So I'm just trying to relate to some of the questions that have been posed and to how this fits into the bigger scheme of things that we try to achieve in terms of developing public service excellence, because that's what we want to do. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, do you know why did I ask this question? If you take your HRDs in public service, you take the Batopila principle was introduced. There's eight pillars which it stands on to better service delivery, to better your human resource out there. There's another thing out there now, Kaidu, to show managers how to implement or understand the Batopila principle. And this is what is bothering me, because we're making plans and we're putting strategic plans in place, but at the end of the day, we achieve nothing. We achieve half of what we actually want to achieve. So that's why I asked the question, because I think by now I understand we must transform in the one side and then we have to deliver on the other side. It's difficult, but somehow we must put norms and standards in place that we make sure that we get what we want. Because it's not for us. It's for the people out there who voted for us in Parliament. We said to them, we're going to give you a better life. And we must give them a better life. That's why I asked the question, GG. Thank you.
As that said, and also looking, you know, at the bigger picture, the way, you know, the DJ has just explained, and we had this presentation last week on Kaidu. I'm not sure what it is, what watch? What do they call it? Public Management Watch. We have got Sandy on the other side, which is also involved with the training and making sure that we have got the skills that we need in the public. We have got the Public Service Commission on the other side, which also makes sure that, you know, we are on track. I just want to get how do we coordinate all this to ensure that we are all operating from the same level. We all have got the same vision, and whatever little initiatives that we have, different initiatives that we are all in, and the people who are driving them are all, you know, having the same vision. we are together. Because that's what I want to know. So I seem to get an impression that we've got all these good initiatives, but they are not integrated, they are not coordinated well. That's why we are not able to reach everyone's reach. I mean, it's disturbing that at this stage we still have training which is not linked to service delivery. Training which is not linked to our whole transformation process. It's really it bothers me a lot. And I would really like to get that assurance that, you know, we really need to be there.
I want to follow up on that, but maybe in a different form. I'm not sure. We do not have, when we have all this, formulated all this, but we don't have capacity to monitor correctly and properly, the way in which members want. But is it still okay to do things the old way? Because if you talk about Batupile, people first, it's set up as there is a policy. But who should be implementing that? In all local government structures, Batupili is there. Provincial is there. Who's supposed to monitor? Do we expect then that the DPSA nationally should be going and monitor them? Or should we change our way of operation by ensuring that now each province and each government structure, do we have these monitoring structures to see the compliance and report to the national structure? I am not sure. I'm trying to engage you. I'm trying to engage my government. I'm trying to engage us all in the country. Where are we going to? How far have we gone? The mistakes that we're picking up now as we go along, which will make these things to be really implementable. They are very good policies. But you go down on the ground, when they are doing oversight work, they find out nothing of this nature is being done. It's just the policies are there, but the people practically who are doing the work, they don't comply. Who's supposed to monitor? Do you have the capacity from national to go and check these 9 provinces? I say no. Something must be done. But I'm not trying to criticize or interrogate, but I'm trying to say, let us be objective in looking at things. Because now we've gone this far. Practically, we do have something that we can also project to you in order to look at it. This question that Julius is asking, who should act? Who do we suggest that we should act? We don't have a supervisor and a foreman and a manager, HOT, that is going to be in all over these provinces and the local government. Because the implementing structure of the government is on local government. If you now I say, let's close this parliament, next week let's go to all of these local government structures, you find out the policies are there. But who's monitoring the implementation? And who's supposed to do it? You see? Go there on this welfare department. Long queue starting from 8:30 up to 2:00. Nobody just comes out of the office and asks the people, what are you here for? To direct the people to the right queue instead of a person standing there for 4 hours queuing in a wrong queue. But if you go to the bank, they come and say, now, what are you here for? No, you are standing in the wrong queue. Go there, you understand? This is how we should be operating as this government, in order to assist our people. Because other people are traveling from long distances, paying money for taxes to come to the offices, and to find out the whole day is standing on the chain, goes home without achieving what he or she wants to do. It's our responsibility as well. To keep on just interrogating you people there on the ground, what do we put in front of you in order to consider to achieve our objective? It's important to me. Maybe we must give you a chance, or we must engage one another on these things. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think we do welcome this debate, which we see as very robust and healthy. Because I think at the end of the day, this kind of engagement does force us to articulate the things we're doing, but also to think very carefully about whether or not we are going to achieve the purpose we set ourselves to do. Let me say that when it comes to the question of coordination, we do have a cluster system in government. And this department does stand at the heart of the GNA DG cluster, and at the cabinet level, of course, our minister stands at the heart of the governance administration cabinet cluster. Now, those are the integrating structures. Certainly, from our perspective in DPSA, in as much as we are coordinating the operational implementation of government's program of action through the GNA cluster, we do a lot of work to ensure that these various initiatives are linked. And at a formal level, at the formal level of programs, operational plans, conceptions and understandings of how these fit in strategies, there is coordination. Let me give an example of the issue of monitoring and evaluation, because you've posed us the question. We have come here. Unfortunately, I was not able to be here, but I really wanted to be here for the Public Management Watch and CAED. The Public Management Watch is a specific monitoring and evaluation initiative by the DPSA, which is demonstrating to you that we have the tools and the capacity to monitor in terms of some key indicators of human resource management performance. It's not a system that's going to tell us everything in terms of human resource management, in terms of service delivery, etc., etc. But we developed a system where we can access available data and generate reports to you on a quarterly basis, which will give you some key performance trends in a particular area. We also are developing other reporting frameworks, one of which is the HR utilization report, which will give an added dimension to what we're doing. We have also shared with you another process we're involved in, which is the service delivery improvement plans and seeking compliance, because we believe that if we are able to achieve compliance in terms of service delivery improvement plans, then we will be in a position to determine the extent to which there is compliance with Batupili. At the heart of Batupili, at the end of the day, for our citizens, is service standards. And departments need to ensure they have them and that they are able to perform against them and continually seek to improve their performance against the standards that they set for themselves. Now, that is a dimension which we will be able to bring into the Public Management Watch as well. So I think it's important to see the development of the monitoring tools that we are developing as a modular process. We can't suddenly say, here's the tool which will show you performance on each and every aspect of public management. Here it is, we've developed it, here are the reports. We're going to have to build it up in a modular way. And it's the same with a government-wide monitoring evaluation system. The presidency has developed a compendium of national indicators. Those are standard indicators, which all line and sector departments need to report against. So by having standardized indicators, you begin to generate information which is comparable across the board. And this Public Management Watch system fits as a transversal system within the government-wide monitoring evaluation system. So we believe, coming back to this particular aspect of things, as indicated, the framework itself will generate the tools and the reporting processes which will allow us to come back to you after a year of formal implementation of the strategy and consider how successful have we been, to what extent is there an uptake, is there greater rigor in the implementation of human resource development within the public service. We think we will be able to do that. There are challenges, however, which we need to state up front with coordination. And I think I have stated them in this house before. Unfortunately, one of the problems of bureaucracy, whether articulated by Max Weber or Karl Marx, is that it generates particular sorts of interest. And it generates the notion of turf. So it would be true to say that many actors within our system of government, at whatever or which in whichever branch, do pay more lip service to coordination than actually practicing the principles of coordination. And that is a challenge that we do face. So we do have the structures through the GNA. We do have a number of task teams which deal with particular aspects of the GNA work, be it human resource management, single public service, monitoring evaluation, and so on. But there is also a challenge of turf protection and lip service to coordination. So that's a real challenge we face. But I think we are working very, very hard to try and mitigate those limitations. And I think certainly within the GNA cluster, we are developing a level of rigor which is forcing greater coordination, greater involvement from the line and sector departments that need to support and implement the various aspects of the GNA cluster work. And included in that is this particular matter that we brought before you today. Thank you, Chair.
You call me to order if I am out of phone, but I'm just coming at a point where this very interesting point is being raised. The point about the capacity to monitor the implementation of policy. I just feel that in the spirit of debating issues, as we agreed that we approach these issues more as debates than as just mere briefings. And actually, in addition to what the DG has said, I think we need at some stage, and maybe that stage is now, to then say, are these questions really still relevant? That we may say we are not as an entire country, we're not in a position to see to the implementation of the policies that we have made. And I think we do have the instruments that are there. I mean, the instruments have been developed. We may just have to be sharpening and addressing them. In addition to what the DG has said, I think there's also this issue about the government-wide monitoring and evaluation, which actually is an intervention that is meant to address some of those things. There is what is referred to as service delivery inspection. And those are things that we need to then say, yes, instead of saying that we have plans, do we have strategies, do we have capacity, we should say we are doing something. But how far enough is this thing that we're doing? And maybe some of these things ask ourselves as we're out there in the field doing work. Also, something that comes closer to the key responsibilities of members of parliament as individuals and also as members of committees. Parliament has that inherent responsibility in the family of organs of state in any democracy to do oversight. To what extent are we doing that as individuals? Such that maybe at some stage we'll then be able to then say, I was trying to monitor the implementation of policy A, and this is what blocked me on this date at this time in this province, at this sub-region, in this office. So that when we do that, we'll then begin to realize that yes, it's true that no one in a democracy is supposed to be a spectator. We are players. If you're a member of parliament, whether you're from the ruling party or from the opposition, but the fact of the matter is that you took an oath, and that oath that you took is not to promote the interest of your party that may tend to be narrow and sectional at times, but it's to actually promote the interest of the republic, the interest of the state. Do we have policies? Yes, if we have policies, to what extent do we go addressing these things? So that we will then be in a position to even clear some of the obstacles that are there. We will very soon, I'm saying very soon, because it's actually not around now. Let's before I come to that point, let's look at the area at local government level. We do have the IDP process. What exactly is the IDP process? Beyond the question of coming out as a list of priorities, is there as an instrument that we can use to monitor the implementation? Because we'll then be able to then say, let's look at everything having been identified. Let's see as to the extent to which we have gone in terms of implementation. The issue of tax will come very clear there. That you see, delivery is taking place at the local government level, but really, sector departments at provincial and national level, they have a role to play. How do you address this question of the inter-sphere cooperation and also interdepartmental cooperation? These are some of the things that we actually need to address. I think when we do that, we will begin to realize and prepare ourselves, get ourselves ready in the unit and others. Get ourselves ready to begin to understand even the concept of a single public service. What is it all about? I'm saying that I one has to actually raise some of these things so that we don't become champions of complaining, but we become agents of transformation ourselves, because that is what the oath that we have taken means. We can't look at what the department is saying only and not look at ourselves. Also, it takes an informed public to make sure that democracy thrives. To what extent are our people themselves able to actually hold the department accountable? Because you see, accountability does not necessarily go along with seniority in a democracy. As long as you understand that the constitution entitles you to a particular service, you are then in a position, also in terms of Watsupili, to insist compliance with Watsupili right at the local level. And if your public representatives will then be in a position to actually get in touch with these people that we claim to be representing, hear what they say, and see as what are the blockages, what are the stumbling blocks. I put my debate there, Chairperson. If I'm out of order, it's fine. It's okay. But that's my contribution. We need to begin to look at these things so that it's not actually the question of us receiving the briefings and stuff like that. It's a debate. What do you know about the South Africa that you claim to be an active citizen of? Thanks.
It's not that the two of us agree on these things, on practical terms. Because maybe what you call this coming together, the term that we are using, Rich, the coming together of these departments into one meeting of this public service and administration, what is the term that we are using, Lindell? I want to be. You know, if we can workshop ourselves about our responsibilities, the way we are outlining, people will stop just coming here and going, coming and going. Because you are putting the nail just on the head, hitting. very correctly, that we go there on the ground, we don't know that is our responsibility. When we are there, even to educate those people that are there about what is their responsibility. You understand? That is the problem we have in this institution. Maybe it's because of these more than 1 million meetings that we're attending. From one meeting, we go to the other. But going on the ground, we have to monitor that and talk to the staff that is working in the office. What is their response? What does this Matupile mean to you and all of you? You understand? Now, Julius every time is complaining about the service delivery. We're supposed to be there. You're all the time you're here. But on the ground, a lot of things are happening. Right in the rural areas where your constituency is. Do those people understand things the same way that you and I understand? Because we do have this opportunity of engaging the departments the way we are doing. But do those people have the same opportunity, or do they take it as unemployment? And at the end of the month, they must end their salary and go. I think it's our responsibility. At times, some people want to fight with me when I say, let's close this institution sometimes and go and look at whether these good policies that we're setting up are operative or not. You understand? Other people want to fight with me. And Kay is one of them who's fighting with me. Okay. Now, I say, Gigi, then, it's good to engage one another on these things. I don't want to see or to hear other people after 20 years of our operation. They come to form another party. This ANC-led government is nothing and useless. Well, it's got good policies. The only thing we don't ask ourselves, even the opposition as South Africans, what are we doing to our people? Are we against these policies or not? Everyone will say it's good policies. But what is lacking? Are we checking as to whether they are implementable or what? Whose fault is that? Is it our fault or what? For me, every now and then I wake up 5 o'clock and bother and come to this institution. But things on the ground are not operating as we all are supposed to see them happening. It's a problem. But I can't say, let's stop for a month and go on the ground. Balega as a speaker wants to be seen also doing something, wants to formulate a report, we'll call region them. There's a special workshop, a joint will do the same thing, because they've got a responsibility as well, they must report what are they doing. If we are not here, they don't have a work to do. So we have to look at those separations of powers also thoroughly. What do they mean to us as public representatives? I'm not sure if there's somebody, Julius?
Yeah. Just want to inform Comrade Balo Yenubek. You know, you go out in your constituency, like that is your job, this is what you're supposed to do. I go to the police stations and I say to them, listen here, Station Commander, I'm not here to play politics with you. I'm here because I'm a member of parliament. I want to hear what is your shortcomings here. How can we together fight crime? Give it to me. And I take it back to Parliament. I write a letter to the minister and say to the minister, this is what we find in flower. You know what? You know what happened, Mr. Reed? They found one another in the constituency. The station commanders. You know, we can't speak to Zulis. He's a member of the DA. The area commissioner is going to fire us. I go to Home Affairs. The same thing happened. So, what I'm saying is, somehow, we must workshop something and say to them, listen here, those people got the work to do, you must assist them, they want to help you. I'm not there to fight with you or play politics with you. I'm here to see how can we deliver. If you walk into a police station, right, and there's a complaint, and you see that something is wrong here. Last year, I drove down the main road and freed him down. Then I see, there's a black man lying where you were knocked down by a car. In the street. And you know what I noticed? A police van was coming towards this accident on his own time, stopping by one small pedestrian robot, a red robot. But there's a man laying in the street that needs the service. And then I approached him. I said to him, listen here. Now, unfortunately, it was a white policeman. I said, listen here, I believe somebody found you and report the accident. And apparently you ask, or that person said to you, a black man has been knocked down. So it's not important to you to rush to the scene. But if you chase a drug dealer, then you want to rush. If it's a black drug dealer, then you want to rush. But for accident, you can't speed it up. She said to me, yes, you must speak to my superior. You know what I said to him? I said, listen here, you, don't put that on record. I said to him, you go to hell with your superior and all. I'm talking to you about the service, not about your superior. And that is what we experience out there. Okay, thank you.
Okay, you have a last one. This is very interesting.
You know, so there is a perception that, you know, I have a problem with leaders in government because I always complain about leadership. And my understanding of the basic principle of management is planning, organizing, leading, and controlling, which is about mental and training. And I think most of our heads of departments and people in leadership in our government do all these other things very well, planning, organizing, monitoring. The actual leading is not there. And that's about, you know, ensuring that the people that you are leading understand their roles, they know where they are going, they know what they're supposed to do. And you motivate them, make them to be willing to do their work and to do it enthusiastically. I just want to give an example of the Americans when they wanted to put a man on the moon. You know, that team, they used to gather almost every morning to say, guys, this is where we are as far as reaching our goals is concerned. But they would get everybody within in the team. They don't make the team explode, and they make sure that the tea lady understands her role. Why is it important that at 10 o'clock everybody should have their tea? Because she understands where they are going. They understand that the person who cleans, who keeps the room clean. It makes the point that this person understands why they have to give. How is this cleaning contributing towards achieving the goal of putting a man on the moon? But do our people who are supposed to implement, do they understand their role? Do they know why they are there? Or they are just there to get paychecks at the end of the month? So that's why I want to challenge our manager that they have got to lead our people on that. Because I think we've got policies in place. We've got monitoring tools like the teaching of that system. Everything is almost there. They have coordinated to say, but why are we not reaching our goals? Because people don't understand, they don't know what they are. I may have gone to school and understand my work as a financial manager. But why are they in that particular department? What my role is there, and how do I contribute to ensuring that the goal is achieved? It's something else. Thank you, Chairperson. So I
and you learn yourself and don't run and go, boy!
Yeah.
And then you sit down and you know, let's say you want to get into the car, let's open the driver, how to drive, he will go with other police and that's the way it goes. Now, I think what the police is saying
is that we are being empowered by information. The staff that we have, these clerks and all of them, are in this institution. I cannot see when they are on the ground, they cannot speak to the people there on the ground. Because we think that we are the only people that can run this country. But once we inform the community on the ground there, they do things better than you and I are doing. You understand? Because they are informed of what is their role, what they should do, and are failing to do that.
You go for a month now for a whole recess. You ask each and every individual member, what have you done? We are going to go according to those guidelines that the race is going to formulate. It ends there. But it goes beyond that. You come to a rural area where people are illiterate. You have to come down from clouds to the surface of the earth and speak the simplistic language that is known and understood by those people. Those people are more active than you and I, because they are always on the ground, they know. They control the police, they control everybody. Whoa, you can't do this, you have to do 1, 2, 3. Why we are not doing it? Now I'm trying to say then that sometimes I get so frustrated to be in this institution because I want to be there on the ground. My experience is always to interact with the people on the ground, to explain to them the little knowledge that I have, I must share with them to make them to work. And that is our responsibility. Will you do that when you come back, Rich, and call a workshop of all of these leaders, no, which are in
the parliamentary that the honorable members can speak, the chairperson experience in working with people to lead them to Christ. But yeah, on a more serious note, I think when we do our work and interact and we find challenges out there at the level of implementation and we feel that we want to initiate a debate on those issues, to make sure that those things are followed up. We try as individuals sometimes we have problems. I mean, there's nothing that as this committee we may not reflect on actual experience that we may actually get as a report from our own area. We have been out to provinces and we're supposed to actually do oversight, but what informs us in terms of the target of areas we want to attend to should actually be feedback that we receive. If more tendencies of areas where you find that the service is wanting in terms of improvement, you might want, if that is in the home affairs area, we might want to let's target home affairs and stuff like that. But really, there should be no problem. Of course, it also depends on how we approach this situation. So maybe let's talk about that. I'm not saying that you're not approaching them, but also it does matter as to how we. Which would seem like sort of, you know, when they see you, they see a false finder. Obviously, that's going to harden their attitude. They are participating in terms of providing you service. You find that where they were supposed to show you a door that leads you into the house, they will actually lead you to a door that leads you out of the house. You know, those are some of the things that we actually. But if we look at one another as partners, I think, of course, there will be those elements out there that really you realize that they will not cooperate with any person unless that person is a direct superior. I don't report to you. This mentality is still there in some of these things.
Your hand was up.
Yeah, just to contribute to this debate, I think one tool in my view, which I think is not being used to the maximum, is the performance management and development system, because that is the crux of the whole approach to public service transformation, contract management, because it says the SMS, if they really follow the guidelines, you know, as devised by the department, where senior management actually are being employed on the basis of how are they going to implement the strategic goals of the government. You see, I mean, if the executive authority says, this is what I want you must achieve, and then you enter into an agreement and say, now, I am going to do that, and you are going to be compensated the bonus and other things, you know, because it goes with that. And it also brings in the question that now, if you have got any weaknesses in achieving what you say you are going to achieve, come up with a plan to develop. HR comes in there. But now, I wonder whether do we really come with a proper contract that says now, you are a HOD, you are a chief director, and so on, for various components. And in terms of this systemic approach of the strategic plan, what, and so on and so on, is being properly what's called. To me, that is a key issue. So I'm not sure, really, whether this contract is being managed properly. But there are some indications from the, if you look at the report of the Public Service Commission, there are challenges around it. And I think if that era can be tightened, we can really bring about some improvement. So I'm not sure whether the model is really not good, but I think if really can be tightened up, especially around the contract itself, you know, and as well as those people who are called SMS, who are given this huge responsibility, they actually get into a proper, you know, contract with a political hit. And actually when they're being monitored, accordingly. Perhaps again, we can do something. So I feel very strongly around that now we do have this instrument, but I'm not sure. Perhaps there will be a need to ask the other department or the commission to conduct some study around the contract management and how it is being implemented. Thanks.
Maybe you want to make an input before we proceed to the next point.
Mr. Jay, just before the Jay, please. I was listening to Mr. Baloyi in the back, to Comrade Baloyi. And I was listening to Comrade Benny in front of me now. You know, I come up with a solution. How can we speed up service in a way? If the members of parliament, if they get this, what do you call this? A centre of bonuses to go out and do their work in their constituencies. Maybe then we're going to see service delivery, sir.
I don't want to entertain that. Precisely because when we're all involved in this liberation struggle, we're not looking off incentives. We wanted to be free, that's all. Now there's money.
Yeah.
The attenders and all of those things are making people to be lazy. I hear what you're saying, Jules, but I don't want to entertain it enough. Let's have another round of debate sometimes and discuss it. We want to be paid about the good things that we must do for our people. I don't think it's a right approach. Let us try to politicize ourselves as we used to do during the liberation struggle. Maybe things will come right. Did you?
Thanks, Chairperson. I think when we look at many of the inputs and presentations that we make here, and indeed the one we've just made, what we really are focusing at the ultimate end of things is on improved service delivery. That's really what the focus is. We don't want to do this because it's a nice framework, very coherent, simple, straightforward. What we want is improved service delivery. We want to ensure that we have the necessary human resources in place and that those human resources are developing in order to improve service delivery. And even when we come with as large and as bold an initiative as the single public service, that's what it's really all about. Now, we will be debating that, no doubt, and discussing it in the months to come. But I think it's very important that we start on the note of really clarifying that our understanding of improved service delivery is about integrated service delivery and increasing access to integrated service delivery at a local level. You see, we can't deliver from a central level. We can't sit in these buildings or in the union buildings or in Bakatiri House in Pretoria and deliver services. Those are delivered at the local level. And that's where we want to see improvement taking place. And it's not only improvement in the quality of service, it's also improving accessibility of those services, making sure that the masses of our people out there, those who really, in a historical sense, have been deprived of access to service delivery, are going to be able to access service delivery in a simple, integrated way. That's really the end point of that. And I think it's very important we understand that, because I already think that, you know, the tone of the debate can be spoiled, if you like, if we're focusing on issues of centralization and so on and so forth. Because really what we are trying to achieve is optimal service delivery at the local level, because that's where people access their services. Now, what is it that it takes? I think the Honourable Member has indicated that leadership is a key ingredient for this. A lot of the elements are there. Policy, planning, implementation processes, monitoring, reporting, evaluation. It's how these are pulled together through the exercise of strong leadership that we're going to see the results that we want to see. I think that's a very important point that has been made. And linked to that is this whole question of performance management to ensure that our leaders are performing at the required level. And obviously the matter we've brought forward today is central to the process of performance management, because through performance management we need to identify the gaps and ensure that we plug those gaps through appropriate human resource development interventions. Now, one of the things that we can consider going forward, for me, as the DG of DPSA, I personally would be prepared to move on to a 95% guaranteed package. In other words, a system whereby you only get your 100% if you have performed satisfactorily. Because that is something that would instill a culture of performance management within the leadership echelon of the public service. Maybe controversial, but I'm standing in this house as the DG of the DPSA and saying that I personally would be quite open to us moving into that kind of framework. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
July this year. Currently, in terms of the interim arrangements, I am the chairperson. And we really welcome this opportunity to take you through a presentation on the Government Employees Medical Scheme. We believe it's a highly progressive initiative of the developmental state to introduce a closed scheme for government employees. We're going to be talking to the policy objective and background. We're going to be talking about the scheme. We're going to be talking about the corporate entity. We're going to talk about progress and challenges. And the bulk of the presentation will be delivered by Dr. Watson. But just to go to the policy objective, and the overarching policy is really about the state as an employer seeking to ensure that there's adequate provision of healthcare coverage to public service employees that is efficient, cost-effective, and equitable, and to provide further options for those who wish to purchase more extensive cover. Now, if we look at the historical scenario, I think basically what we need to say is that under the old subsidy, the state covered up to two-thirds of contributions up to a total of 1,014 rand. 550,000 employees accessed the subsidy, and that means that in a public service of just over 1 million, fluctuating between maybe 1 to 1.1 million public servants, only roughly half of them accessed the subsidy. 44% of covered employees had reached the rand cap, and 380,000 employees did not access the subsidy at all. And we'll elaborate on that, but that's where your key challenge lies, because as you'll see, it's historically, we also need to recognize the medical scheme industry, if we look at the history of it, coming through apartheid into a democratic South Africa, we still have that problem that beneficiaries of medical schemes are largely the historically advantaged. It's largely a white industry catering for white people. That's the history of the medical aid industry. And obviously in the public service as well, if you look at the majority of those not accessing medical aid coverage were in the lower paid levels of the public service and predominantly black people as well. So I think these are some of the challenges that we faced. And it provides also the rationale. Now, developing further, we have a situation of employees enrolled on 68 medical schemes. We're looking at the state expending approximately 5.4 billion per annum on medical aid subsidies. We also looking at a pattern within that of 91% of covered employees on 15 medical schemes. So we're looking at a huge amount of state resources going into medical aid cover, and yet we had a prevailing situation of inequity. And then, despite the fact that the state as employer is pumping all these resources into the medical aid industry, there's no ability on the side of the state to control, to influence the various medical aid benefits provided by different schemes. At the same time, you get excessive annual increases within the industry. And overall, a challenge of lack of value for money. So these facts, if you like, that we presented to you provide some of the essence of the rationale for why it is that we've embarked on this initiative. Now let's just look at this inequity and balance that I spoke to. And what we see quite clearly is what I've already articulated on the left-hand side, you have salary level 1, moving to salary level 16 on the right-hand side. And in the purple color, you have those that are covered, in the yellow, those that are uncovered. And clearly the trend that I've spoken to indicates, is manifest in that graph, which shows that the lower paid workers have historically been uncovered. They haven't been able to access the subsidy in order to get medical aid benefits. And this is really why Cabinet approved that we embark on this initiative to establish a closed scheme for government employees, and therefore approved ultimately. We went through a lot of work, as you can imagine. It's a very complex industry in many ways. When you get into the detail of it. And we went through a lot of feasibility studies, actuarial studies, and ultimately we came up with proposals which led to Cabinet approving the registration of GEMS in 2004. We then began to enroll members in 2005. And basically what he's saying is, given the historical inequities, given the character of the medical scheme industry, we as government, in terms of the objectives of the developmental state, are going to intervene in the market. We're going to intervene in the market because the market has failed us. That graph that we've showed you indicates that the market failed us. It didn't deliver medical aid cover to the poorest workers in the public service. Furthermore, we moved for a more equitable subsidy structure, which was negotiated in the PSCBC and finalized last year, July. And we've also engaged at the level of the President's Coordinating Council. And decisions there were taken that across the public service, executing authorities, DGs, HODs, are to actively promote employee awareness of the scheme and the new subsidy policy, and that all employing departments create an enabling environment for GEM communication activities. In terms of the new medical subsidy policy, all new employees only receive subsidy on GEMS. So if you are new to the public service and you want to access the subsidy, you can only access the subsidy by joining GEMS. You can't just come in and join any other medical scheme. That's the one decision that was taken. All uncovered employees only receive subsidy on GEMS. So if you've been historically uncovered and now you want to get cover, you get it through GEMS. And then all employees on GEMS access a new or receive a new subsidy, which is 75% of contributions up to a maximum of 1,900 rand, which obviously is bigger than the 1,014 rand, which we saw existed prior to the July 2006 PSCBC agreement, and which remains the subsidy level for those who have been receiving cover from other medical aid schemes and elect to continue with their existing medical scheme arrangements. But also, as the developmental states, we introduced a very progressive initiative because we were saying that on our lowest benefit option, if you are in levels, salary levels 1 to 5, we will subsidize you 100%. So for employees on salary levels 1 to 5, we give you 100% subsidy if you join the Sapphire option, which is the lowest benefit option. And if we look at salary levels 1 to 5, we're talking about 325,000 employees, and 191,000 of them are uncovered. So potentially we're saying to 191,000 employees in the lowest salary echelons that we will give you 100% cover if you sign up with the Sapphire option of GEMS. As I've indicated, existing employees on open schemes continue to receive up to 1,014 rand. And if they move to GEMS, they will be no worse off in terms of the subsidy. And then for pensioners, the benefits remain as is. I'm now going to hand over to Dr. Watson, who will take us through the rest of the presentation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Members of the committee, other guests and delegates in attendance, we presented to this committee about 2 years ago. At that stage, we didn't have an office. We only had a little certificate with GEMS registration number. We borrowed an office in the DG's building. We have moved quite rapidly since then, and we'll unpack some of the work we've done in the last 2 years. At the level of the scheme, it's important to appreciate what it is. It's a restricted membership medical scheme, much like parliamentarians have with PharMed. It's a separate legal entity, takes the form of a body corporate in terms of the Medical Schemes Act, essentially belongs to its members and is capable of suing or being sued. Membership on GEMS is limited to employees and pensioners of national and provincial departments and administrations, and employer groups as approved by the board from time to time. An example of those employer groups would be the Social Security Agency. The scheme was registered on the 1st of January 2005. Enrollment commenced on the 1st of January 2006, and it subscribes fully to the prescripts of the Medical Schemes Act. The benefit options, I won't go into too much detail. I had brought some handouts describing in more detail what each benefit option has on offer and how much the benefit options cost. But essentially, we have five benefit plans. If we look at the right-hand side of the slide, we have Emerald and Onyx, which are your standard or your traditional options. Most of you on medical schemes would be familiar with their design. Hospital benefits are provided at private facilities and unlimited. And for out-of-hospital care, there are various monetary limitations. So you can choose your provider subject to the limits you have in place. The difference between the two is really the size of the limits. We have Ruby, which is your mid-range option, designed for those members who wish to take some risk themselves. Hospitals, benefits are unlimited, provided at all facilities, and there's a savings account where 25% of the monthly contributions are placed in the savings account for the use by the member. We then have Sapphire and Beryl, which are called network options. These options are designed to be less expensive than the others. In exchange, members sacrifice the choice of their provider. You go to network providers. Both Beryl and Sapphire have out-of-hospital private networks in place. So you can see GPs, pharmacies, pathologists, radiologists, and specialists, provided you use the network. Beryl has a half a million rand private hospital limit where you use the network private hospitals. It essentially covers about 72% of the hospitals in the country at the moment. And Sapphire makes use of the state facilities. Where the state facilities don't offer members of Sapphire the care they need in terms of their benefit, we have a supplementary benefit which provides for them to get it at a private facility. The options are not static. As the scheme matures and as members voice their opinion, the options will change to be in line with what members want. We designed these options because they are quite familiar to public servants who are on other open schemes. So when you look at GEMS, you can see more or less the one you are on in one of these five options. Our member services are exemplary. We certainly supersede what is the industry norm. We have 12 regional centers, two in Gauteng and in Cape Town, and then one in each of the other provinces. We have a dedicated call center with over 140 call center agents, a dedicated fax line. We were the first medical scheme to introduce a please call me SMS line. Essentially, employees who don't have money or who can't afford to call us will send us a please call me and we'll call them back. We used to allow employees to state the preferred time, but we could see people were taking advantage of this benefit. So now we call you back when you SMS. We have a separate confidential HIV and AIDS helpline, which gives you access into the AIDS for AIDS program. Emergency medical services are provided by Netcare 911. Our website is up and running, and there is interactive facilities where members can type in their membership number and then view essentially their benefit profile, how much they have available and what they've used. We have a chronic medicine fax line, the postal facilities, and we have a host of email addresses. The main email address is inquiries at GEMS.
but we also have dedicated addresses for complaints, suggestions, compliments, and other specific activities. If we look at the entity, the corporate entity, it's that structure which allows members to enjoy what you see in the brochure. The governance and management structure is a simple one. It certainly is unique in the industry. We have a board of trustees that directs the scheme's activities, same function as a board of a company. The principal officer or chief executive who implements these directives, and the scheme executive who supports the principal officer in managing service levels and contractual obligations of appointed service providers. The head office design is efficient. It allows us to outsource operational activities, but always constantly monitor the performance of the scheme at a financial level, at an operational level, even at a member satisfaction level. What is unique is that the locus of control always rests within the scheme. Mandates, approval, decisions, strategy are issued by the scheme's office, not by a provider. We are not at the mercy of any one of our contracted suppliers. Our strategic focus more broadly, as far back as 2004, is to always understand employees' healthcare needs, to monitor trends, to remain a competitive scheme, to ensure that we are sustainable, to encourage primary healthcare and the role of the GP as your gatekeeper, to incorporate innovation where indicated, to ensure efficiencies and eliminate wastage, and always to promote broad-based Black economic empowerment. Our operational structure, just graphically, our key stakeholder is a member, but you can't be a member unless you are employed by this employer. So we have a relationship with employees and the employer, and our members are first and foremost. Members see the scheme. They don't see the contractual arrangements, performance agreements, and SLAs. So what gives them sight is the Board of Trustees and its committees, the principal officer and the management team, supported at that level by advisors, actuaries, auditors, and so forth, and then a host of service providers who we've appointed on contracts which run for no longer than 3 years. It may look like a host of service providers, but even on most medical schemes, you do have these providers. What we have as a level of comfort, each of the companies you see listed there was appointed based on a tender process. So dealing with the multiple providers, it is important to note that we don't want to manage any degree of disintegration. We don't want a member to be disserviced or treated badly because company X says they couldn't do their work because company Y hadn't done something. We don't have time for that. So we've introduced another innovative measure, a cooperation agreement. Effectively, it's a contract which binds our providers to be willing and able to constructively engage, integrate, interface, and participate with all other service providers that we contract. Impressively, we are not a party to the agreement, but it's bound, they have to be a party to the agreement. If any one party in any instance fails to cooperate with another party and subjects our members to a loss, be it financial, emotional, or physical, we hold them all jointly and severally liable, and we penalize the whole group. That's the structure of the agreement. The Registrar of Medical Schemes is very impressed with it and is now recommending it to a number of medical schemes, also at other companies. Multiple companies who work for them. If we move more specifically into the progress, I will try not to take too long. The first highlight of the progress we've made is we've approved our strategic plan. We approve one annually because the scheme is young. It's not appropriate that we plan long-term, 5 to 10 years. We need to look at each year to ensure we set it up properly. Our vision and goal is for GEMS to be an excellent medical scheme. To do this, we believe there are 7 key things we need to succeed at, and those are the strategic objectives which form the plan and essentially are my performance agreement. To execute communication activities and member affairs exceptionally, to satisfy stakeholder requirements and expectations, we have a host of them. We're not like any other medical scheme. We have an employer who is government, but there are 140 employing departments. We have employees who are members of more than 8 public sector trade unions. We have employees who are not members of unions. They are in all provinces, in all departments. There are more than 29,000 schools in the country. So managing our stakeholders is not an easy task. an objective. Another objective is to ensure sound governance, accountability, and legislative compliance, to operate efficient and effective scheme services, to manage the finances prudently and transparently, to optimize our corporate services because we have employees, and to manage risk effectively. Just dealing with progress at the broad level. In terms of governance and management, our first financial year ended on the 31st of December. We received an unqualified audit opinion. The scheme actually turned a small operating profit, net profit, for its first year, which is remarkable. We've had an independent board performance appraisal implemented and concluded. The findings have been considered by the board itself. Overall, the board and its committees have functioned very well. Our annual report has been submitted to all members of the scheme and to the regulator. In line with what the chair, my chairperson has said earlier, promoting accessibility, we've revised the rules to ensure that we can allow employees access, maximum access. So we've allowed employees to put on their grandparents if they're financially dependent on them, siblings, children of siblings, accommodating essentially the unique family arrangements that sometimes do exist. We have had open and transparent member elections. These were signed off on Monday night by auditors to confirm them as free and fair. The board and its committees are functioning optimally. We've performed our annual risk assessment and our corporate services are established. GEMS itself employs 18 people and our policies and procedures are similar to those of the public service. In respect of financial management, we collected over 220 million rand in our first year, in 2006, in contribution income. This year to date, we've collected over 750 million rand. It's projected we'll collect over 2 billion rand in this financial year. We have seen significant operating profits coming through in March and April, and we monitor and will continue to monitor our cash flow, solvency, and financial performance regularly and quite intensely. The scheme is young and is growing constantly, which means we have to keep an eye on the finances. We subject our claims experience and financial performance to actuarial peer reviews on a monthly basis. And we have already begun to realize optimal tariff structures for items like medicine, hospitalization, and service categories. As the scheme grows, we will further harness our collective purchasing power to better to sign better contracts for members of our scheme. Members are our key stakeholders, so some of the material you see is how we engage with our members. Quarterly newsletters are distributed. Member letters, SMSs, and emails are distributed regularly. We have over 150,000 visitors to our website on a monthly basis, and we perform updates weekly. We've had over 9,000 people visit our walk-in centers this year, and total complaints received this year are less than 0.05% of all member interactions in this year. We have also put in place a systemized mechanism to deal with all complaints and identifying the causal factors for them. Moving to member enrollment, the scheme is only 18 months old, but we have grown rapidly. As of last night, we had exceeded 142,000 principal members. GEMS is the fourth largest scheme in the country, having been the smallest of 133 at the beginning of last year. In about 2 or 3 weeks, we will become the largest closed scheme in the country and the third largest medical scheme. Take-up in the Northern Cape and the Western Cape now exceeds 20% of all the eligible employees. So essentially, 1 in 5 employees in those provinces are GEMS members. 50% of our members, in keeping with our attention to accessibility and the promotion of equity, did not use the subsidy before. Awareness and marketing takes place through roadshows, presentations, dedicated SMS and mailing campaigns. We will, in the third quarter of this year, introduce a telemarketing service, because we now receive about 2,000 calls a day from employees who want to join. It needs a dedicated call center and function for that. Graphically, our member enrollment, the chart shows the last 16 months from 2006 January up to May, and you can see our growth. the subsidy that was implemented in the public service in July last year, you can see that from about July, enrollment began to increase quite rapidly. The provincial spread of our members, of the people who are registered on the scheme, shows Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Western Cape as the largest contributors. That's in keeping with the fact that they are indeed large employing provinces. If you measure our impact, at 140,000 members, we now cover 15% of our target market. The Northern Cape and the Western Cape, we cover more than 20% of the employees. The Eastern Cape, we cover about 8%, but what is quite impressive, in September last year, we covered less than 1% of the employees. So we are beginning to see quite a rapid turnaround in the Eastern Cape, in the education sector in particular. Member services are core, despite how rapidly we grow. We have operational processes which are continuously monitored and evaluated. Where indicated, a process and procedure is amended and or replaced with immediate effect. If something doesn't work and it agrees our members, we seek to change it or fix it. All supplier service level agreements are reviewed and monitored. We apply penalties where necessary as part of the provisions of the SLA. We have more than 200,000 member interactions on a monthly basis now, and some of our operational statistics in our first 18 months are illustrated in the table. We've received over 1 million telephone calls from members. We've received over 42,000 emails. We've received over 65,000 please call me SMSs since we implemented the service, and we've made 127,000 outbound calls. Continuing on the member services, we operate in a service industry. When people sign up, they expect excellence. They don't expect us to come with an excuse or to even justify mediocre service. They expect excellence. All complaints are received through our office and then routed to the service provider, so we are able to audit the quantity and the content of each complaint. Our standard operating procedure provides for them to be dealt with within 48 hours. And in the month of May, we received a total of 133 complaints. 133 on more than 360,000 lives that we cover. We strive to have that figure drop down to naught, but the key issues coming through in the complaints is around member education, so people didn't understand things properly when they joined up, or they failed to read the information that was provided. We have seen some subsidy and contribution issues. There have been issues at the level of the payroll system. They haven't effectively managed, in some instances, to pay over the contribution and calculate the employer subsidy properly. So there have been problems. They are directed at us, but not always our fault. And there were some issues around the delivery of chronic medication in January, which is as a result of us introducing a service. Challenges. We have five key challenges at the moment. I think the first one is exceeding member expectations. That certainly is what we're supposed to do as a medical scheme. Managing constant member growth is a challenge. Collecting contributions from members who leave an open medical scheme and come to GEMS is indeed a challenge. The payroll system waits until the old scheme removes themselves before the GEMS contribution goes through, so that has caused an issue. Managing our financial performance is indeed challenging. We're growing rapidly. We don't apply waiting periods or underwriting criteria. So you can join today on the 1st of June, enjoy benefits through June, but your first payment will only come on the 30th of June. As such, we have to keep our eye on the cash flow. And a big challenge, or a more important challenge, is that we've seen Sapphire membership increase 40% this quarter, the first quarter of this year. But the DG outlined the scope we have. And it is challenging to have employees in 1 to 5 who are eligible for the 100% subsidy. Come on. Most of these employees have never been members of the scheme. So you can't just run into telling them, join GEMS, you can get it for free. We first have to go through what is the scheme, what is the subsidy, and how does it work for you. So that is a challenge we're working on. I'm pleased to say that in the last 2 months, we've seen Sapphire growth month on month actually being the second highest on all our options. So I think as the year progresses, we will see Sapphire numbers pick up. In conclusion, Chairperson, members of the committee, we've gained a lot of experience since we last met. We've had to deal with member enrollment, variable member enrollment, interacting with the employer and employing departments. We've established operational infrastructure. We've tested our financial management. And we've instituted procurement and contracting procedures that have stood the test of more than 14 contracts. The policy objective the DG opened with is in part being met. Over 50% of our members didn't access the subsidy in the previous 12 months, and we receive over 700 new registrations a day. We do cover only 15% of the target market, so it's too early for us to celebrate the fact that it's a success. There's a lot of work still to be done. These are significant accomplishments for any new medical scheme, but there is much work still to be done. Thank you, Chair.
Do you want to say something? Okay.
Hello?
Hello? Chair, before I say anything, I'm on a very positive note. You know, strangely, I have heard so many people talking about GEM, encouraging each other to join GEM. As far as KZN, it's a very positive note. They seem to be very excited about it. This was a good thing I picked up. But I want to know, can you unpack this one? What is this service integration? I didn't understand it. What do you mean? The second one was you spoke of the enrollment. I thought you enroll individuals, not groups or unions. I did not understand that either. The third one is, had it to be a doctor to manage this medical doctor, because it's a medical scheme, I would like to get my clearance on clarity rather on that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would also like to join my colleague in saying that GEMS really, despite the presentation itself, but the feedback that we get from the people on the ground, they are generally very satisfied with the service that you're providing, hoping that you try to do even better. Now, my first question is on the benefit options. You said your benefit options are not basic. Do you mean that they are flexible in terms of the members themselves moving from one option to another? Or are you also looking at yourself providing more options in this or both? And then secondly, in the spirit of broad-based black economic empowerment, I just want to know who your auditors are. And then finally, looking at your challenges, you have indicated that we have, the challenge of having to keep a very close eye on your cash flow. And now this practice of allowing members to enjoy benefits before they actually start paying, do you think this is something that will be sustainable? I don't want us to go into a situation where when we change at a later date, especially when more members join, then we are unable to provide that. It should be perceived as having been a way of checking people, and once we have stabilized, now we start to change. That's what we are, whether this we think is sustainable. Thank you.
Thanks. Let me also join my colleagues. in appreciating this most progressive initiative, especially that it will ensure that healthcare is made accessible, especially to all public servants. We appreciate that. And I think if my calculation is correct, those actually did not have access to such a facility. It's close to 200,000, which really is a significant achievement. I've got only one question. What's the provision regarding a post-retirement period?
Okay, DJ. Thank you. Service integration, I think I may have been moving a bit fast. What we have, if you look at the companies at the bottom, are the companies who are hired by the scheme. So we have an administrator, we have a managed care provider. For those members of PharMed, that's 848 and Solution, where you phone in when you want to go to hospital. And Med Scheme is your administrator. Now, we have different companies. We don't want a member to need to go to hospital, and the hospital says your medical scheme rejects you. And when the member phones in, the administrator says, no, it's not our fault, it's that company's fault. So to prevent that happening, we have them bound by a contract which says they are jointly liable for any integration between themselves. So if ever something happens, like the example I gave, we would penalize them all for not integrating. And they would sort it out amongst themselves who is to blame. We don't have the inclination to want to point the finger and blame. They must attend to it and they must pay the penalty. So I think that's just the agreement. Essentially, because typically you'll find in schemes and companies, these quarrels between service providers can become all-consuming. And you don't want it to distract from your business objectives. Enrollment of individuals, we do enroll individuals. You apply as an individual member, but we interact with groups. So there are 325,000 or 335,000 educators, but they're in 10 different employing departments, national education and then 9 provincial. So to have access to them, to go to their workplace, to present, to put up posters, we need to interact with the employer. Otherwise, they, in some instances, treat us like an open medical scheme and refuse to let us in. So I think we deal with the group at that level. Doctor, to manage the scheme, I think it's in spite of my being a doctor that I managed the scheme. It's just coincidence. I suppose it's healthcare. The benefit options being static, I think what I meant to say is that how they look today for 2007 is not how they may look next year. We have a process where annually we revise the design and members use a suggestion process to tell us if there's something they want to change. I mean, an example would be on Monday night we had a petition from a social worker who wants us to increase social work and she had 12 members sign. So we will consider all these things and if need be, you create an additional option, or you can reduce them by one, but with members now part of the board, it's at the discretion of members of the scheme. So they will evolve as we proceed. Our auditors, as you can see, are Sizwe and Saluba. That's a black-owned audit firm, so I think we meet you on the BBBEE. And our internal auditors are Nkonki, which is another black audit firm. They're not on the slide, I think I ran out of space. So we use 2 black audit firms, and we contract with them directly, not as a consortium. So it's them in their own capacity. Underwriting, typically a closed medical scheme doesn't apply underwriting. They don't apply waiting periods. So if you went to work for Standard Bank, because it's your condition of service that you join BankMed, you have immediate access to cover. The challenge it poses for us is simply that we just have to watch. Because if we had, let's just assume 140,000 people join in this month. We would then be covering 280,000 people on the money collected on half. So we're watching it, and I think at this point in time we're comfortable it's working. But it does mean we must keep our eye on it. I don't think it's something that will change. I think if somebody were, if let's say a young woman was appointed in the public service and she's pregnant, to make her join a scheme because of the subsidy and then say you can't have your pregnancy covered, I think would be unfair. So I don't think it would come in. Post-retirement, from, I think, two aspects. From the scheme side, we receive pensioners, as long as you're a pensioner of an eligible employing and employing department, a national or provincial department. The post-retirement subsidy is determined by DPSA, and at the moment it remains the same. So employees get, I think, two-thirds of their contribution up to 1014. So you can join GEMS whether or not you get a subsidy. If you were a pensioner who retired in 19, I don't know the dispensation so well, but if you don't receive an actual pension subsidy, post-retirement medical subsidy, but you want to join, as long as you prepare to pay the contribution, we as the scheme will have you. Thanks, Chairperson.
I think we've come to the end of this, but I'm not sure it's in terms of reference for the oversight, because I'm not sure this is my last day I'm living, whether maybe we can arrange this for another time or not, I'm not sure.
Shall we... We may not defer it any longer, because this oversight visit come in as soon as we come back. But what we might want to do is that it will not be for the first time. When we went out for the same visit, because this is a follow up, we did work on some sort of guiding us, who can distribute to members without having to discuss this matter here. Who can just write and send them in their respective constituencies. Those who are not going over these, definitely would then be able to get something. Some of them are not going over
these. Thank you very much. We highly appreciate your input today. We will look into it. But although we're raising all these questions in general, we're also not properly capacitated to look, to follow up on these things. Because of these more than 1 million meetings that we have in this institution, that's another problem. But we'll come back after we come back, we return from the recess and see what strategy can we do. Device in order to be on par of the development. Yeah. Now, we're not going to just interrogate now. We want us to be objective as well. Where do we want to go? Together with you, to engage you and you engage us as well as decision makers. To those viewers, I thank you very much. Is there any last advice? From our first talk, there's a large array at the Max building.
Thank you for that.
Don't whisper, Jane, talk to me.
That's go on another drive, no, I won't support it.